This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how is the coronavirus pandemic playing out in the greater Middle East? What effect is it having on the political, economic, and social landscapes of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Iran was already reeling under the reimposition of sanctions by the Trump administration when Tehran was hit hard by the pandemic in March. And the plunge in oil prices has only exacerbated economic hardship as revenues from this major commodity shrink. In addition, according to numerous media reports, Iran has been taking an increasingly provocative posture by increasing uranium enrichment above the limits set in the nuclear deal. In neighboring Iraq, the number of coronavirus infections is far lower. And finally, Baghdad has a new prime minister after more than 5 months of disarray. Mustafa al-Khadimi was chosen by the Iraqi parliament and is the country's first real prime minister after Adil Abdul Mahdi resigned in November 2019 in the face of anti-government protests. According to the New York Times, Mustafa al-Khadimi is known as a pragmatist, capable of mollifying concerns of both the United States and Iran, two rival powers competing for influence in Iraq. Nonetheless, Iraq faces enormous challenges given sharply lower government revenues from low world oil prices and endemic corruption. We'll also discuss the implications of the coronavirus pandemic in war-torn Syria and Yemen. Despite a unilateral ceasefire announced by Saudi Arabia in early April in Yemen, UAE-backed separatists in southern Yemen declared self-administration. Analysts say the new rift between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi in southern Yemen exacerbates an already unstable situation where Iranian-backed Houthi rebels control the capital, Sana'a, in the north. Well, joining us to analyze the impact the COVID-19 crisis is having on the greater Middle East are two distinguished regional analysts, and they are no strangers to these modified VOA microphones. Ellen Lapson is professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, a college based in the nearby state of Virginia. And Jennifer Caffarella, fellow in national security at the Institute for the Study of War, or ISW, a policy group based in Washington. And both women join me via Skype as we continue to social distance. Ellen Lapson, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Carol. I'm glad to be with you.
And Jennifer, it's great to have you back on the show as well.
Thanks, Carol. It's a pleasure to return.
So, Ellen Lapson, let me begin with you. Let's talk about Iran first. There are more than 100,000 coronavirus infections. Approximately 6,500 people have died. Ellen, what is the toll that the continued U.S. pressure campaign and then the pandemic and more are taking on the Islamic Republic regime's grip on power?
Well, I would just say let's also add to the mix the sharp collapse of oil prices. Iran, after all, is one of the oil exporting countries, even though there are restrictions on its exports these days. So it's a triple blow between sanctions, oil prices, coronavirus to the Iranian economy. But we have to remember the Iranians have demonstrated a level of resilience over the years. The sanctions realities have become kind of a chronic condition. So Iran is always underperforming economically. That does lead to grievances among the Iranian public, but I would not assume there's going to be any direct linear relationship between economic stress and political instability. I think that the mullahs and their coercive instruments of power are not deeply threatened. There have been moments in the last decade, actually, from 2009 to the present, where the Iranian public has spontaneously risen up against their government. But to the best of my understanding, that does not mean that the regime is really in trouble right now.
So Jennifer Caffarella, a resilient regime, do you think that there's not much of a link between this enormous economic stress caused by the plunge in oil prices, as well as sanctions and now the coronavirus, and political instability?
I would agree with Ellen, and I think the key factor here is time. Perhaps not in the short term, right? As Ellen said, there will not be an immediate substantial destabilizing effect on the Iranian regime. But I do think we need to widen the aperture a bit and consider what is the cumulative effect of these kinds of pressures over time. It is entirely possible, for example, that Iran will face a second wave of virus outbreaks. It's a continued risk. Iran is far from recovered, actually, from the full toll of just the coronavirus, much less the compounding factors, as have been mentioned, of the sanctions and the broader collapse of the oil market. So I do think the Iranians are headed into a period of increased difficulty. The question, as always, with regimes like this is there a breaking point? And how close are they to the breaking point? I don't think we yet know. We're still relatively early, unfortunately, in this overall crisis. And I do think we need to continue to watch whether and to what extent the pandemic does, in fact, remain a dampener for public protest. Thus far, it has, across the Middle East and other parts of the world, dampened protests that had been ongoing against government failure and corruption and a whole host of other issues. But in some places, including in Iraq, right next door, we are seeing a resumption of at least low levels of protests in an attempt to sustain and in some ways revive that sorts of pressure against the government. And I do think it's entirely possible that we will see those protests resume in Iran, and we'll have to watch how the Iranian regime responds to it under these conditions.
Turning back to you, Ellen Lapson, what about how these various factors are affecting Iran's control of proxies in Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon? Are these various factors, the devastated economy, sanctions, are they weakening the regime's ability to do more mischief, or is it actually exacerbating, you know, their grip on these various proxies?
Well, I think we've seen a couple of trends over the years that occasionally Iran does step back and say, can we really afford these adventures beyond our borders? And part of the protests in Iranian society has been the resentment of spending more money in Syria, for example, than they're spending at home. So the Iranian regime has had to be a little bit attentive to that. But in reality, the support they're providing to various, you know, non-state actors around the region isn't hugely costly. They can sustain some level of engagement with these groups without overcommitting themselves financially. So I think that it may be off by a few degrees, but I don't think we should see Iran as kind of coming back to the mothership and saying, well, we had all of these proxy relationships, now we don't want to do that anymore. I think it is still very organically part of Iran's foreign policy and its national security policy.
Jennifer Caffarella, what's your take on Iran's support for these non-state actors, these proxies in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, for example?
I would agree. The regime has shown no intent to pull back on its regional project, which, of course, it regards as a existential requirement for exporting the axis of resistance and extending the Iranian revolution. So we should not expect the Iranians to step back. Now, whether the Iranians are more vulnerable to disruption in their regional campaign, I think is a different story. The Iranians, of course, have suffered pandemic outbreaks and actually deaths at high echelons within the Iranian regime. We don't know the full extent of how the pandemic is affecting its proxies, but we know that Lebanon has been hit very hard, for example. Hezbollah has been hit hard in both Lebanon and then in Syria, where they are deployed in large numbers. So I do think it is possible that the Iranians are going to need to recover the momentum of their regional campaign. Unfortunately, headed into this crisis, the Iranians were doing quite well across the board, despite the American financial pressure, in part because the U.S. has been pulling back from the region. I do think the U.S. and our interests are at risk in Iraq, which we can talk more about here on this segment. And Iraq has been a primary focus of that Iranian regional campaign to consolidate and build out that proxy infrastructure. They're not going to walk away from that. And in fact, we've continued to see the Iranians invest at high levels in these regional projects, including shaping the government formation negotiations in Iraq, as well as a spate of high-level Iranian military commanders visiting Syria in order to continue their project there. So unfortunately, the Iranians are going to continue their campaign, although we should watch whether regional actors, including the Israelis, do actually decide to take opportunities to stress the Iranians further. The Israelis have launched an expansion of their military campaign against Iran inside of Syria, and we need to watch to see what effect that actually has on Iran's ability to continue its campaign in Syria. I don't think it will actually force Iran out of Syria, which is Israel's new stated objective. However, it could have a disruptive effect, and so it's definitely something worth watching moving forward.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Jennifer Caffarella, from whom you just heard. She's fellow in national security at the Institute for the Study of War, and we are discussing the impact of the coronavirus pandemic in the greater Middle East. Both panelists join me via Skype in keeping with social distancing guidelines that prevent us for now from broadcasting from our beloved VOA studio. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to all our Muslim listeners who are observing the holy month of Ramadan. We wish you a heartfelt Ramadan Kareem. And now more than ever, we love to hear from you. So please send feedback to encounter at voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And Ellen Lapson, let's turn now to Iraq. There's a new prime minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi. Tell us what you know about him. How optimistic are you that he can deal with the multiple crises, from the violence between the Iranian-backed militias and U.S. forces to the resurgence of ISIS, and not to mention, of course, the loss of revenues from oil and so forth?
Khadami comes with an intelligence background. He's not seen as highly political. He has a reputation for getting along well with a number of the current senior figures. But so he almost comes through as a technocratic candidate rather than the head of one of the very contentious political factions in the country. So it did take the president of Iraq, Barham Saleh, you know, third try to find someone that would be acceptable to the parliament. So, you know, I don't want to exaggerate whether one individual is going to be able to transform Iraq, given the nature of its problem: domestic unrest, this long extended governance crisis, being caught in the crosshairs in the U.S.-Iran struggle, the COVID, and low oil prices. So this poor country has so much being thrown at it. So at least one of the major problems seems to be, for the moment, resolved. There's probably a lot of relief in Baghdad that at least the government can go back to being a fully legitimate government. You know, you can have an acting prime minister for a while, but things kind of stall out. So good to have a truly, you know, legitimate authoritative government now in place. They have not finalized all of the cabinet portfolios. I believe they approved 10 of the 15 positions in the cabinet. Foreign minister, as I understand, is still being negotiated. So, you know, look, this is a task ahead of this new prime minister that you cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, expect success on all fronts. He will have to, you know, navigate very carefully. And, you know, managing the different demands of the U.S. and Iran has become, you know, a huge challenge for any Iraqi government. I hope he's of the category that, you know, really does want to put Iraqi sovereignty as, you know, one of his animating principles, so that he will not be seen as the client of either Tehran or Washington. I think establishing his independence, establishing a more effective Iraq for Iraq policy, I think will be an important task for him right at the beginning.
Jennifer Caffarella, what's your take on the new Prime Minister al-Khadimi and his significance at this very unique time and his ability to balance the influence of Iran and Washington? That's really going to be a challenge.
I do think he certainly presents an opportunity, both for Iraq, but also for the United States. I think he's up against a huge suite of challenges. I think Ellen categorized those quite well. And I do agree that we have to be realistic with our expectations of what one man can achieve, given those challenges, and especially on what kind of timeline. The Iraq that he inherited has deep structural challenges, failures of government, corruption issues that he will have a very difficult time tackling without losing the support from the delicate balance of power brokers that he has managed to gain. That doesn't mean he can't do good. He certainly can. There are opportunities. But I do think it's critical in this environment that the United States acknowledge that continued engagement with Iraq will be necessary. We are headed into a new round of negotiations with the new prime minister for a potential strategic framework agreement to govern the U.S. role in and relationship to Iraq. Unfortunately, thus far, the U.S. seems to be signaling that we are going to further draw down our forces in Iraq, potentially to half of their current level by the end of 2020. I personally think that that's not the correct way to approach this kind of negotiation, because it actually decreases our leverage at a moment when Iraq needs American support quite badly. And at a moment when the military pressure that the Iraqi government faces from a resurgent Islamic State is actually increasing rapidly, I'm very concerned at the ISIS resurgence that we are seeing, which has spiked quite substantially in April and May as ISIS wages its annual campaign to mark the holy month of Ramadan. And I'm quite concerned that the Iraqi government will actually fail to suppress that ISIS resurgence without current levels of coalition support. Furthermore, I'm concerned that an American withdrawal, or at least reduction in forces, will cede further opportunity for Iran and its proxies. We, of course, do need to find ways to neutralize this escalation within Iraq, which is jeopardizing all of these issues that the new prime minister needs to resolve. However, I think it's important from an American perspective to acknowledge that Iranian proxies have been escalating against the United States in Iraq, which has been taking defensive measures. Those escalations are going to continue, and they could actually expand. We're seeing indications, for example, that the Iranians could be preparing to escalate in Syria next. And so, unfortunately, it's not possible to fully separate out these local issues of structural reform that the Iraqi government must tackle, including the budgetary issues that the new prime minister must tackle, from the wider strategic picture. And I'm concerned, as I've noted, that an American retreat at this stage is actually only going to accelerate the challenges that this prime minister faces.
Alan Lapson, are you equally concerned about a retreat by Washington in regards to the resurgence of ISIS? And what about the protests, the protesters who are probably no longer on the streets because of the coronavirus pandemic, but I'm sure this simmering resentment against the current, you know, political structure, that's going to be another challenge for Khatami to deal with. What's your take?
Well, so I think on the security front, the resurgence of the Islamic State will at least give momentum to retaining some level of counterterrorism cooperation between the United States and Iraq. And I think that is something, even within the framework of wanting to draw down our military footprint in the region, we might be able to accommodate that. But I think let's remember that the status of American forces in Iraq, you know, it takes two to tango. The political will of the Iraqis has shifted on this question. And so they are the sovereign actor who probably almost certainly doesn't want us there anymore in some kind of extra sovereign territorial presence. So we really have to assume that that drawdown is something that is happening in part because of Iraqi politics, not just our own preferences. But I want to switch to the civilian side of the strategic framework agreement. You know, there has been a strategic framework with Iraq since 2010, but it was terribly underutilized, particularly on the civilian side. So even if we have to draw down and have a much more modest military mission in Iraq, and I hope it will be focused on counterterrorism and training Iraqi force, helping them professionalize their armed forces. There's so much work to be done on the civilian side, restoring higher education, health conditions, dealing with water scarcity. I think that we have kind of neglected that side of U.S.-Iraqi relations, so I'm still hoping that some of those kinds of programmatic activities would be sustained under a new framework, even if the military arrangements are in the direction of scaling down.
Well, turning back to you, Jennifer, I would like to just move on now quickly to Syria and Yemen. You have your finger on the pulse of Syria. Can you give us the state of play on this never-ending conflict and the proxy interests that have torn this country apart?
Certainly. Unfortunately, it remains the case that Syria is headed into a period of prolonged conflict, which has been worsened by the outbreak of the coronavirus, which is far worse in regime-held areas than the regime is actually admitting. But we're also seeing new signs of potential instability within the regime for the first time at any significant level since the start of this war in 2011, which has some pretty profound destabilizing potential. It remains to be seen how this new rift will play out. But it's quite dangerous. We're seeing now public statements from a major power broker within the regime, Rami Makhlouf, who before the war owned perhaps up to 70% of the Syrian economy. And he's now speaking openly against Bashar al-Assad, appealing to him for now to halt the seizure of his financial assets, which the Assad regime has begun in a desperate attempt to stay afloat amidst the combined financial pressures of American sanctions, the U.S. effort to block reconstruction aid from going to the regime, and now the impact of the coronavirus, including the secondary effects of the collapse of the oil market, which is affecting Syria in multiple ways. I raise that because so far in the war, regime-held Syria has been relatively stable on the course of the conflict, and we could actually be headed into a completely new phase of the war, which I would candidly say very few, if any, observers actually have the ability to predict how that unraveling, if it occurs within the regime, could actually unfold, given the level of the opacity of this regime. There's just so much that we don't know. We're not sure how fragile it actually is from within. But these big moves by power brokers and the deep divisions that appear to be forming could have a fundamental effect on the war, including the extent to which the regime is able to muster additional combat power to attack Idlib in northwestern Syria, for example, but also potentially creating a new breakout opportunity for ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other insurgents that have already begun a slow reconstitution in areas that the Assad regime had ostensibly recaptured.
Alan Lapson, this is a topic for a whole separate program, but anything to add or subtract to the situation in Syria and this geopolitical nightmare that seems to be unfolding?
Yeah, well, I think Jennifer's following it more closely than I am. I guess I still do think that it's important to also see Syria as an opportunity for both Iran and Russia at some risk. They are taking risks by being over-identified with this extremely complicated picture. Are they running the show? Is the Assad network still really calling the shots or not? I think those will be questions that historians will need to be looking at.
Well, let's close now by looking at Yemen, another country that's reeling under civil conflict, the most fragile health infrastructure one can imagine. And now we have the Saudis who declared a unilateral ceasefire in April. But in the south, there's this Southern Transitional Council, which declared self-administration. You know, as if the country didn't have enough problems with the Houthi-controlled capital, Sana'a. So how do you think that's playing out, again, in the backdrop of this COVID-19, which analysts say if that really reaches Yemen, it will be a catastrophe, humanitarian and otherwise? For you, Ellen.
I do think they're now reporting the first case in Yemen. You know, it's just such a humanitarian tragedy. The health system has virtually collapsed. People will just have to, you know, let this disease run its course, which will only add to mortality figures in the country, I'm sure. And the country is kind of fracturing, but it's not the first time that's happened. So I do think that the separatists around Aden, there's a long history to this. And I'm very curious whether the Russians are a little bit tempted, since South Yemen had been a client state of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So we don't know how much encouragement is coming from outside actors. It certainly only adds to the complexity. We certainly understand that the Saudis at some level analytically understand that it's time to get out. It's not been a great success for them, and they're really kind of acknowledging that now. It's also caused a little bit of a rupture between them and their assumed ally, the United Arab Emirates. So poor Yemen is both the victim and the cause of some more regional turmoil.
Turning back to you, Jennifer Cuffarella, for the last words on Yemen, the fact that we're seeing a split between allies, between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi over what's going on in the south. Nonetheless, there's this larger conflict between the Saudis and Iran over the Houthis.
Yeah, I do think the risk of ISIS and Al-Qaeda exploiting these extended divisions within the Yemeni war is high. That unfortunately remains a perpetual concern, again, especially in this Ramadan period in which ISIS does typically resurge. Thus far, we haven't thankfully seen a significant ISIS reemergence inside of Yemen, but it could still unfold, especially if the instability does get as bad as some are expecting. I would zoom out from that to say, though, I do think that a unfortunate consequence of the combined pandemic and oil market crash across the board is that failed states or states that were failing are sliding deeper into that condition. I think that hopefully we will have a rallying effect in that leaders will actually manage to stem the tide of some of this across the board and stabilize to the extent that they can. But I would highlight from a sense of a bit of optimism that this is an opportunity for American leadership across the board. Unfortunately, thus far, we've sort of turned inward, partly for good reason, given the scale of the pandemic that we face here at home. But I think it's simply important to note that American leverage, American diplomatic engagement, American humanitarian support goes an incredibly long way in helping communities like this respond to crises like this and in creating the diplomatic conditions for actual conflict resolution, rather than what the Russians can offer, is actually to hijack conflicts like this and repurpose them to suit Russia's objectives.
Well, as always, ladies, we raise more questions than provide answers. But for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ellen Labson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Jennifer Caffarella, fellow in national security at the Institute for the Study of War. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.